everyone, and welcome to episode 30 of season 11 of Move Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we currently our way through the 2001 award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today on this first Friday of February is Father David Mowry, the chaplain of the Movies by Minute community. Welcome back to the show for yet another enlightening season.
Reporting for duty, Rob. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very happy that you came back. You know, I always like having you on for these spiritual pieces of movies. So it'll be interesting to hear your thoughts. Well, at least when we get to next Tuesday, but we'll see what next Tuesday will be more of from. Well,
there's some soul searching that's going on.
Yes,
early on, even.
Of course,
it doesn't. We don't have to wait for the chaplain to show up
because
there's clearly something going on in one of our privates in Easy Company.
Yes, there is. All right. So episode 30 begins with the men walking off in the direction of Carentan and ends with Winters still giving orders to the men. Let's start things off by what's your history with Band of Brothers?
Band of Brothers was a part of my college experience. I went to seminary for my college years, training to become a Catholic priest, and the entertainment on the weekends, it was usually movie night, and Band of Brothers was really popular in the seminary for obvious reasons. There are a lot of themes in this miniseries about banding together, esprit de corps, leadership, overcoming adversity, the forming of brotherly bonds in the face of overwhelming forces, and the lessons that are on offer in this miniseries were really inspiring to young men who were thinking about a life of service. And our teachers and formators in the seminary encouraged our watching of the series because of the teamwork and the selflessness that are displayed by the members of Easy Company. And fortunately, no one at my seminary was ever like Sobel or any of the other rotten commanders or officers that Easy Company have to deal with over the course of the series.
That was lucky for you.
Yes, very blessed that way.
Yes. All right. Excellent. So let's just dive right in. So we ended things yesterday with Welsh getting the command that they're about to go take Carentan. And he and his men start walking off in the direction of Carentan. And then the shot changes, and now it's night. And the men are walking through, I guess, the remnants of a battlefield, because we see a lot of destruction. We will shortly also see a lot of death on the ground. You know, this is, not long after, I think this is probably like the 11th or something like that at this point. Later in today's episode, they're going to tell us that it's already the 12th. So this is the 11th at night, I guess, from that perspective. And, so there's been 5 days of battles going on around this area. I don't know who was taking this area. It's probably just other men from the 101st that were fighting in this area. But we see burnt out tanks, other vehicles. There's even what looks like fire coming out of the water, in the pond that they're walking past, which, again,
all right, must be oil burning on top of the water.
Yes.
Well, it's a very hellish landscape, and as we're following Blythe as kind of our main point of view character through this episode, we meet Blythe on this bright day, and he's watching that dark cloud of smoke work its way across the sky. But it's daytime, it's lit, he's back with his platoon, but it's also him coming out of hiding and not being entirely sure what his role is going to be in this conflict. And now he's part of the company. They're on the march. They've got their orders, and they've marched into hell. They've marched into this bleak, landscape with fire everywhere and ruined cars and trucks. And you have this macabre scene where, and this is where I'm going to need your help, Rob, because I always have a hard time keeping all the members of EC Company straight. It's because they're
I
all
don't know
wearing the
all of them.
same
I know a lot
costume.
of them. I know a lot of them, but I don't know all of them. Yeah.
So the fellow who picks up the watch off of the
Okay,
corpse,
that's
which one
right.
is that?
That's Perconte.
Okay.
We'll talk a little bit about that because I mean we saw in the previous episode that he was, you know, they're looking for souvenirs.
Yeah.
As
Yeah,
many
and
as they
so
can find.
this kind of scavenging moment with the corpse is all of this is kind of bringing home for Blythe the inhumanity of war, and it heightens our uncertainty as viewers about like, oh, how are these men going to navigate a landscape that seems so hellish.
Correct. I mean, part of the whole thing also is that I'm assuming you've also seen the Pacific.
I have not. No, that's been a lacuna on my watch list for a while.
Okay, so the
You wouldn't talk
Pacific,
about hell on earth, though.
yes.
Oof.
Well, that's the thing. The Pacific is much more graphic and doesn't try to portray the men as being saints. I mean, in Band of Brothers, I mean that they don't portray them as saints, but they also don't show everything. I mean, I've heard from people who've spoken to the men that, you know, after the show came out, that's when some of the stories started coming out of things that these guys did that weren't necessarily, I guess you can say, weren't necessarily kosher. How's that? That's probably the best way to describe it. But the idea was is also because a lot of the men were still alive at the time, they didn't want to bring up a lot of the stories of things that they
Right.
questionable things that might have happened along the way. Now, once the Pacific came out almost 10 years later, 9 years, it came out 9 years later, most of the people that they were depicting were no longer around. So they could get away with having something that's a little darker, or actually I would say a lot darker, not a little darker. And this one, you know, here they try to give us a more optimistic look at the whole thing, you know, from that perspective. So yeah, it's an interesting way for them to, you know, they're showing us the bleak area of what these guys are all going through. But every so often, like this little shot that we're about to talk about with Perconte, you know, you got to also remember these are 18, 19, 20-year-old kids,
Yeah.
who are there from their perspective, they are there as saviors, you know, of Europe. But, you know, they grew up in small little towns where, you know, whether they were you know, believers in the Bible or not, you know, they knew, okay, you're not supposed to kill, but now they've been given permission to go and kill. You know, this is what you have to do for freedom. And, you know, and again, when you're dealing with teenagers, they might not know where they might not know how to properly balance the boundaries of things, I guess you can say.
Yeah, and that comes up in the foxhole conversation that Blythe has with his lieutenant about, oh, it's all a game, just advancing the ball
Exactly. I
1 yard at a
mean,
time,
right.
or it's Spears talking about you gotta give up hope. You gotta say that you're already dead, and then you're gonna be an efficient soldier. And the way that the soldiers were talking about their souvenirs in the last episode kind of shows that kind of game mentality. They don't necessarily empathize with the soldiers, at least as they're depicted in this adaptation of what actually happened. In
Well,
real life, it could be otherwise.
the book does talk about it a bit, but again, it's very possible that things are much darker than they really than they're depicted, you know, from that perspective. So the men are now walking through this hell on earth, and they come across some dead bodies, and Hubler, you know, passes by one of them and goes, "Don't wake up, Jerry." Again, a little bit of dark humor there. And you see that there are numerous dead German soldiers on the ground. I don't think they show us any dead U.S. soldiers at this point. But
No, I don't think so.
exactly. And so again, we don't know what exactly happened here beforehand. But as the men walk past this German corpse, they just step over him. No one even takes the time. They just look down and just continue walking. And then we get to Percante, who then looks down and sees that this guy's hand is just is reaching out towards something. And he then just takes off his watch. And again, as we talked about yesterday, he liked keeping souvenirs. He's got a whole armful of watches.
And I can't imagine these are very good watches because I expect that the German troops, like the American troops, are pressed into service. It's a draft, and so these are not exactly going to be Swiss timepieces that these German soldiers are wearing. But I mean, it's still a watch. It's still going to sell
I
for,
don't think he's
I don't
trying
know
to
how
take them in
much.
order to be able to sell them on the black market. I think for him, it's just to be able to
But then why?
take
I mean,
something
why
home.
so many watches then? You just run out of wrist space if you take a watch from every corpse you come across. Maybe it's early enough that he doesn't quite catch that yet. I just it strike it's an interesting contrast between this moment where he takes the watch as a souvenir, and then you get Blythe's face afterwards. Because it's one thing to have the soldiers talking about their souvenirs in the last episode; it's another thing to see them scavenging from the dead. And to do so in a pretty nonchalant manner without any hint of revulsion from touching the corpse or taking something from a dead body. And we're meant to emphasize with Blythe's position, where he just looks very thoughtful and out of his depth in the midst of what other soldiers are treating as very normal.
Exactly. But again, when you're in a situation like this, you can't be, I guess, detested by the fact that there are corpses all around. I think that's part of it. That the what these guys have to do is they just have to move forward. I don't know the actual answer to that. But again, these guys like to take souvenirs from different things. I mean, which we will see throughout the course of of this entire mini series. There are a
Yeah,
number of
boy.
them that all
And
have
wouldn't it be
permanent scars.
ironic if one of those souvenirs ended up causing one of the soldiers trouble, maybe later in this episode?
Yeah, exactly. That's part of, and well, that's one of them, and then there's another one that someone gets later on that causes even more damage. So yeah, it's unfortunately, those are based on true stories. So it's not a literary device. It's not as if they say, oh, let's put in Chekhov's poncho or Chekhov's Luger. Those type of things. It's just, life gives you real Chekhov's literary foreshadowing, I guess you could say. From that perspective. And as you said, Blythe walks by and just looks at this. And actually, before we talk about Blythe, so the funniest thing that Percanti does with the watch is he shakes it to see if and puts it by his ear to see if it's actually ticking.
Right.
Maybe
Well, because that's all they're it's only worth it to him if they're still ticking, because that's what he shows off
apparently, but
at the
maybe the
in last
Right, but
episode.
maybe the idea is that he sets each of the watches to a different time, and then he says, well, this time tells you what time it is in Chicago, and this time tells you what time it is in LA, and this one tells you what time it is in Tokyo. I mean, I don't know. I guess everyone has
Well,
to,
he does
you
that
can find
later
a hobby.
in the episode that in this episode three, he does that later, where he talks about, oh, it's 9 o'clock back
Which
home,
it isn't.
and so there starts.
Whatever.
Oh yeah, so he's setting them to different times, but he doesn't necessarily know
Exactly.
that he's right.
Yes, he's incorrect because I mean we'll talk about that I think later next week, but the idea is that he says it's 9 o'clock back in Chicago, and there's no way that that's 4 o'clock in the morning because it's completely bright and the sun has already come up. So yeah. Or maybe he lived in a town that doesn't, that doesn't go by daylight savings. And I don't know. And then Blythe walks by, and we see that he has this dazed look on his face already, trying to figure out what to do. And then Hubler, who's walking in front of everyone, just stops. And Welsh turns to him, and Hubler goes, "Damn!" And he goes, "What?" He goes, "We lost F Company, sir." He goes, "Again?" And Welsh walks forward to go try and look for F Company, and then one of the other guys comes up to Hubler, and Hubler says to him, "We lost F Company." And then he goes, Percante says, "Again?" Meaning this is apparently something that has happened over the last few days, that they keep either the question is, are they saying at this point that Hubler keeps losing them, or is it that F Company just keeps disappearing? Is it like
Yeah, it
is
seems
this
they
a
don't
jab
seem
at
mad at
exactly.
Hubler about
That's
it.
right. Is it a jab at Hubler, or is it saying that F Company is just not as good as Easy Company?
Or that it's just chaotic and they have a hard time keeping track of F Company. It's never blamed on Hubler that they've lost sight of them.
Right.
It's just something that continuously
Yes,
happens.
apparently. And then he goes, "Hey, Blythe, Skinny, guess what?" And then Welsh comes back and goes, "Percanti, go back and pass the word to hold to the word to hold up." "Yes, sir." "Hubler, take Blythe, go find F Company." He goes, "Yes, sir." He goes, "Come on, Blythe." And at this point, the two of them start walking to try and find F Company, which theoretically they shouldn't be that far ahead of them, but apparently they are. And then we're back with Welsh, and they're not really sure what's happening here. And then Welsh goes, "Oh, shit." And then Winter shows up, and Winter says, "Did you send somebody?" And he goes, "I got Hoobler and Blythe out there now." And then Nixon shows up and goes, "Why have we stopped?" And then Winter responds, "This is about officers crapping out on their training, Nix. Come on, let's get to the show on the road." So again, he it sounds as if Winter's complaint is with F Company. The guys in F Company are just not doing their job, even though they're in front of them. So that you see that's the thing. If you're following the leader and you can't find the leader, does that mean the leader did something wrong or that you did?
Well, according to Winters, it's the leader's fault.
Yes.
Apparently, it's F Company's job to make sure that they're staying within sight of Easy Company.
Apparently. But whatever, what Winter shows us is that all right, we got to get moving. We got to move forward. And then we're back with Hubler and Blythe as they're trying to find F Company. And Hubler smacks his neck and goes, "Dang, mosquitoes!" Now that made me think of like a Vietnam movie, because like Vietnam movies always have people, dealing with even Platoon starts off the first scene, where he's complaining about all the ants, the ants on his neck and stuff like that. But I guess something that you see less in World War II movies, but apparently there are mosquitoes in France also. You don't have to go to Southeast Asia
It's
for mosquitoes.
June in France. You're near a whole bunch of water. You're gonna get mosquitoes that
That's
way.
true. True.
It also shows me that it's early enough in the invasion that the little annoyances are still getting to them, that the mosquitoes are worthy of comment, and they're going to go through so much
That's right.
worse.
Just wait till Christmas.
And exactly, yeah. So you're going to wish you had the
That's
mosquitoes.
right. That's right. And then we hear like a whole bunch of explosions in the distance, and then Hoover stops, and Blythe then whispers to him and goes, "What is it?" And he goes, "Shh." And because he hears someone, and he goes, Hoover goes, "Flash." Then we see a guy come out from behind a tree, and he goes, "Thunder." And he goes, "I can hear you all the way across the field." I guess they weren't being that quiet.
Well, they're slapping their necks and complaining about mosquitoes, and Blythe is not exactly cat-footed as he's tramping through the brush
Very
here.
true. Very true. And then Hooper says, "Are you from F Company?" He goes, "That's right. Where y'all been?" Again, if the last guy is supposed to know where the first guy is right behind him, So I don't know who's at fault once again from this perspective. Then Hubler turns to Blythe and goes, "Blythe, go back to the lieutenant. Tell him we found F Company. I'll figure out where these yokels are at." And the guy from F Company goes, "Hey, who are you calling a yokel?"
But with the most yokel accent, which of course
Exactly.
is the
Of
joke.
course.
I mean, what makes somebody a yokel? Is it your general demeanor? Is it just the air of the country simplicity that you carry with you wherever you go, even into the forests of France?
That is a very good question. I mean, we've talked about yokels in the past. I believe it was in, I have a feeling it was in It's a Wonderful Life that there was a that we used the term yokel. And I mean, the idea is basically, that you have the term country bumpkin. It's a derogatory term for someone from an unsophisticated country people and stuff like that. So.
And our friend here takes exception to being called a
Yes,
yokel.
he does.
Maybe he has season tickets to the ballet, and that's not what you would expect of a yokel. So that's where he is telling Huber to step off.
Yeah, I mean, I remember we talked about this back when we talked about yokel in the past, that you can synonyms for the term yokel are bubba, country bumpkin, hayseed, chaw bacon, rube, redneck, hillbilly, and hick. I guess Hubler decided that this is the best way to describe someone.
I think yokel is less offensive than some of those other
I would
ones.
agree. I would agree. I mean, Hubler himself is from Ohio. I guess in Ohio there are areas, depending on where in Ohio. I mean, he's from a place called Manchester, Ohio. I don't know specifically where that is on the map. Is it close to Kentucky or something like that? Is it, how close is it to the border?
Well, it's down near Appalachia. That would be yokel
Exactly.
territory. Oh, that looks pretty close to
It's
Kentucky to
very close to
me.
Kentucky, yes. Yes. So I,
That's right on the border with
yeah, so I
Kentucky.
guess
So it
it
takes one
makes
to know
sense.
one, I would say,
Yes.
Huber.
Yeah, it is literally on the border. Manchester is on the border. By the Ohio River, and on the other side of the river is Kentucky. So, yeah, Hubler knows that. But from that perspective, you have to give a lot of credit to the writer to know to make a comment like that. It's something that, yeah, you have to, if they would have put a guy like from who's from LA and have him use the term, it would mean something very different than someone like Hubler, quite possibly, as we just said, is living on the border.
I'm not a local. I'm not a yokel. I'm from Ohio.
Exactly.
Don't put that on me.
I live 5 miles from the area where yokels live. I'm fine. So, yeah. So at this point, Blythe starts making his way back, and he ends up finding another dead German soldier, and he happens to. But look at the guy, and something's a little off. He's not quite sure what's a little strange about this, and he gasps a little bit. And then Winters pops up behind him and goes, "He's dead, Private." He goes, "Did you see Fox Company?" He goes, "Yes, sir." He goes, I thought he had me," meaning Blythe thought this guy was still possibly alive. Maybe he's going to shoot him.
I'm surprised that Blythe didn't pull his trigger. I'm surprised that Blythe
I'm
didn't
not.
shoot at the corpse and that he didn't shoot at Winters coming up behind
Well,
him.
let's put it this way. When you know who Blythe is, or at least how Blythe is being portrayed in this entire part, because again, everyone knows that they got a lot wrong about the real Blythe. The Blythe did not die at the end of at the postscript of this part, which we will talk about more in depth later, but it says that Blythe died of his injuries a few years later. But he lived for like 20 years, and he like continued in the army and stuff like that. They screwed up. But the way he is described here is he's shown as I don't know if coward is the right term, but he's not as gung-ho as everyone else. Let's put it that way. And he's much more reserved.
He's a sensitive soul.
Okay, you can look at it from that perspective too.
But just the way that he was just jumping and twitching around in the forest, I would have not been surprised if for him to pull the trigger on that corpse and then again on Winters. Because it seems like so far in this episode three, we've been depicting Blythe as out of his element and not quite having what it takes. And if you want to show an undisciplined soldier, he'd be firing his gun at a corpse just to underline that fact that here's someone who isn't quite ready for
this.
But
he's an undisciplined soldier who hasn't fired a shot yet. I mean, he even talked about the fact that since D-Day, he just was hiding in a hole. You know, he wasn't right. Fighting. So I wouldn't expect him to pull the trigger. You know, he does point the gun first at the German and then swings around to point it at Winters. But, you know, I think that's just instinct because of all the training that he went through.
Oh,
but
sure.
I don't think he's ready to pull the trigger, though. I think that's what it was. You know, and then Nixon says to him, he goes, Balschemhager. Blythe goes, paratrooper? And then Nixon explains, he goes, division thinks there's a regiment of them holding up in Carrington. So that's sort of a little scary, you know, for the men to hear of something like that. And he goes, well, there's one less to worry about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Blythe looks at the flower on the lapel of this soldier, and Nixon goes, that's Edelweiss. That only grows in the Alps above the tree line, which means he climbed up there to get it. It's supposed to be a mark of a true soldier. So again, this is a little foreshadowing. You know, as we were talking before, the souvenirs were not necessarily used as a literary foreshadowing, but this one is, because this part is made up. You know, the whole fact. So we have Chekhov as the Edelweiss.
Did you, like me, start singing the Sound of Music? Edelweiss,
of course,
Edelweiss.
Of course. But you see, part of the whole thing is Edelweiss is from Vienna, is from Austria. You know, it's not from Germany.
Right.
So it's interesting so was Hitler. So maybe that's why he would want his elite troops to come from Austria, or have to go through some sort of test. You know, trying to, you know, avoid the von Trapps with that type of thing. I don't know. Like, go get your Edelweiss, but don't get caught by the von Trapps.
Those singing children roaming the hills, looking to snare any German soldiers brave enough to climb the heights to get some Edelweiss. I find it interesting that a flower is the symbol of the ultimate soldier, a mark of courage and bravery. Because if you're writing, I don't know, a fantasy story or the like, it would be a talon of some great monster or some kind of trophy from something you would have to kill. But that it's this little delicate bloom and flower that you can put in your lapel that is the symbol of gumption and soldierliness. I wonder where that started.
Maybe it has to do with the fact of that it's flower that's hard to get to because you have to go high up into the Alps. You know, maybe it's from that perspective.
Oh, just the difficulty in getting it at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So there are symbolic uses of the Edelweiss. In the 19th century, the Edelweiss became a symbol of the rugged purity of the Alpine region and of its native inhabitants. The passion for Edelweiss, which had previously been neglected, began in the middle of the 19th century. The focus is on an incident from 1856, where the Austrian Emperor Franz Joseph I went on a mountain hike to the Pastersen Glacier. There, the Emperor picked his wife in Edelweiss from the steep rock with the words, "The first in my life that I picked myself." The affection for Edelweiss was a common feature in a famous And the famous couple and this well-known story raised people's attention to this Alpine plant. So again, this is less than 100 years before this happened. So it's very possible that the idea is that Edelweiss is something that's elite. So I can sort of understand from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Again, if it's true about that these elite soldiers were using it. Yeah. Okay. All right. Here it says about the whole thing. So the The Itawas is established as the in 1907 as the sign of the Imperial Royal Mountain Troops by Emperor Franz Joseph I. These original three regiments wore the Edelweiss on the collar of the uniform. Before 1918, there were also innumerable Edelweiss badges in the Habsburg army.
Ah,
Okay,
there it
these
is.
include, for example, the Military Mountain Guide Award, which is an ice axe with Edelweiss and winding mountain rope, the Edelweiss emblems on the collar and cap of or badges from Alpine patrol companies. Many Alpine units, commandos, and soldiers proudly wore unofficial Edelweiss badges. The Edelweiss also played a role in the troops designation, which also reflected the special relationship with the mountains. In addition to the Edelweiss Corps of Archduke Joseph Ferdinand, an Edelweiss division was formed in the course of the First World War. It essentially consisted of Kaiserjäger of the 3rd and 4th Regiments, the Salzburg Infantry Regiment, Archduke Rainier, and the Upper Austrian Infantry Regiment, Grand Duke of Hesse and the Rhine. In 1915, World War I, the Edelweiss was granted to the German Alpine troops for their bravery. Today, it is an insignia of the Austrian, French, Slovenian, Polish, Romanian, and German Alpine troops. So, yeah, there you go.
All right.
So that now we know why.
Now we know.
What's interesting is that the Edelweiss and everyone who knows the Sound of Music, it's actually an anti-Nazi. It was used in the song, and the idea of the emblem of the Edelweiss was anti-Nazi.
Because it was so associated with the previous political arrangement. It was associated with the Austro-Hungarian Empire and before it was swallowed up by the Third Reich.
Correct. That's what's interesting. Oh wow. And the song Edelweiss was actually just written for The Sound of Music. I thought it was a real song. Meaning, I mean, obviously it's a real song because we hear it.
Yeah, that's way too catchy, way too American for it to
There's
be
too much English in
an original German folk song.
it. It's possible. Okay, so now we know why there is Edelweiss here. And at this point, the scene changes, and we're now in the middle of day, and we see on the screen it says D-Day plus six, so Carentan, France. So we are now at June 12th, 1944, and we see Winter starting to scout out the town in front of him, and he starts barking orders, and he goes, "I want you to take the first straight in up the middle, hard and fast. We have to move quickly. I'll be right behind you with second and third." So Welch and his men then take off and start going, and he goes, "Go. Let's go, let's go, let's go, 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 go."
Terrifying. Just the idea to have to approach this town out in the open like this. Now, even if what happens next wasn't going to happen, I would be so scared. I know this is exactly what the military training is for, but the exposure in that approach to the town, it's just a
Yes.
killing field.
Yeah. But again, that's what they had to do in order to take the town. This, you know. And you know, as these guys are running down you know, towards the town, so bullets start flying all over the place. We see a bunch of them get hit and fall down. You know, obviously there's no way of knowing who these men are that are getting shot. They're just part of EZ that are unidentified, I guess, at this point. And the we see that you know, none of these guys know where they need to go, and one of them screams, "In the ditch, down, down, down!" And there are ditches on the side of the roads, and they just try to get some sort of cover on the side, and they're not really sure how to deal with it. And then another soldier screams, "Incoming!" And then we hear a bunch of gunfire, and then one of them goes, "God damn it!" And Welsh looks around and doesn't he just can't find everyone, and he goes, "Where the f is everybody? Where'd everybody go?" Someone goes, "I have no idea." And
Oh, because they're all
that's right.
cowering in the ditch. They're not
That's
there
right.
to back them up, to provide more targets than the poor guys pinned
Exactly.
behind the building.
Well, because you know, you have Lutz and
And this.
Welsh that made it to the building, and everyone else, you know, they just ran to the sides instead of running forward. You know, that type of thing.
Yeah, and this is what differentiates a dramatized history like this from an action movie, because Bruce Willis would just be charging directly into that house and all the bullets would whiz past him. But in combat like this, you need those group tactics in order to establish fire superiority around this entrenched position, because you need to spread out the number of targets that the entrenched position has to ensure that some of your forces can lay down fire on that. There is no one singular hero who would be able to get into that house without a platoon backing somebody up in
Exactly.
order to get close
That's
enough.
100% on the mark with that. And
That's why they're so freaked out that
that's
no one's there. It's just the two of them cowering behind that building, these poor
exactly.
guys.
And then we get a shot of Strayer, back on the hill looking through his binoculars. And as we see in a lot of movies, when you have the officers far back, they're looking and not understanding what's going on. And the Strayer just starts going, "Let's go easy. Get those machine guns moving, will you? Let's get them out of there." Then Nixon goes, "They're in the open, for Pete's sake. Go, go, go." And Winters hears all this and just starts trying to motivate the guys. And he starts running between them, trying to get them to come out of the ditches. And he goes, "Go, go." And he goes, "Get going, Buck." He goes, "Follow me, easy. Move out." Now, again, we've talked about this many times, and we will continue talking about this probably for the rest of this season. Winters was a born leader, and he's there to lead. And for him to say, "Follow me," that's the type of leader that everyone wants. You want to be able to have a leader that's in front of you that is going to inspire you to get up and follow them, even into the line of fire, because you believe in them and you believe what they're trying to get you to do. And I love how they constantly show this.
He puts himself in the most danger to do so. He's standing up, he's the most exposed, and from that position he's then encouraging them. And you feel that exposure with those early establishing shots. You have that great crane shot coming up over the ridge of the road to look at the Cafe de Normandie, and then you just have his head poking up over that, kind of emphasizing he's literally sticking his neck out. In order to lead these men, and will continue to do so after they're cowering in the ditch, and he realizes that they can't stay there because they're going to be no help to the men who have already
Correct.
gone into the town.
Correct. And again, he knows as a leader that you have to find ways to motivate your men and get them moving. And as he's trying to motivate them a little more, this 5-minute segment ends. So is there anything you wanted to add about this 5-minute segment?
No, I think we covered it. I think the display of heroism here is giving us a much more chaotic view of warfare. The taking of the German artillery emplacements in the last episode was much more kind of action movie, kind of. So things are still tense, they're still pretty high stakes, but it's a pretty triumphant excursion for the men of Easy Company. Carrington is shaping up to go a little bit differently and a little bit
That's
worse
very
for
true.
everyone.
Very true. All right. So today's segment is Band Brand, where my guests will give their top five fictional movie bands. Why don't you start with your number five and work your way up?
All right. Number five, a classic movie band. And I know some people will be upset that this band is only at a number five, but I think the other contenders are so strong. I think number five is Dr. Teeth and the Electric Mayhem. The band present in the Muppet movie with just a stellar frontman and Dr. Teeth. But of course,
Animal.
everyone's favorite is
Yeah, of
Animal
course.
on the drums. Standout star. Truly the Keith Richards of the Muppets. Then number four, Marvin Berry and the Starlighters from the Enchantment Under the Sea dance from Back to the Future. They not only show up for a gig at a high school, but they are willing to follow this crazy kid through all the changes on Johnny B. Goode. and they show their great musicianship and tracking with all of those changes throughout the song, even though Marty starts to really get way
A little too
into the guitar solo, which is why I would that's why I would not say that Marty McFly is part of this band, because he kind of hogs the spotlight a little too much. So I would say the Starlighters are a much better band than I would say that Marty deserves. Then number three, and this is kind of a this is a double dipper a little bit, because we've got brother in the title of the movie they're from, the Soggy Bottom Boys from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. They're more of an a cappella group than a band, but I think they qualify. Certainly they have popular success. They're able to bring out those old time spirituals and good down home feelings, across the airwaves of the mythic American South that they find themselves in. And that part of that movie always makes me really smile, because the beards are so obviously fake, and yet somehow they're getting away with those disguises. Then number two, I mean, it's got to be the Blues Brothers. We're getting the band back together, and the blues rhythm and blues review they put on at the end of that movie packs the house and gives them enough money to save the orphanage. And so, I mean, you gotta love a band that's working with the Penguin to
Yes,
save the
it,
orphanage.
especially when it's in Chicago.
Oh, I mean, there is I'm biased as a Chicagoan myself. I gotta give it the Chicagoan, but if that's number two, what would be number one? Well, there is always and only ever going to be the best movie band, and it is Figurin Dan and the Modal Nodes. You start humming any of the cantina music from Star Wars, yeah, people will know that immediately. And even if they don't know Figurin Dan, as they should, one of the great musical geniuses of our galactic times, they know his music. So I would say Figurin Dan and the Modal Nodes, just in terms of movie music, just one of the best examples of movie
Well,
bands.
that is a great list. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, you are welcome.
And now we will play the daily game of Name That World War II Movie, where I will give you some clues and you have to try and guess what movie we are talking about.
Oh boy, okay.
So I will spin the wheel and randomly we will see what movie comes up for you.
I'm really hoping for the best years of our lives. Come on, come on.
No, sorry, you didn't get
Oh
that one.
no.
Nice try. Nice try, but no. You actually get a movie from 1956.
Right, movie from
Okay,
19.
this is it's all about a group of soldiers in the middle of the Italian campaign of 1944. And it stars Mickey Rooney, Don Taylor, and Wendell Corey.
Mickey Rooney, in 1956. So at first I thought, oh wait, 1956, was that Bridge on the River Kwai? But no, that was it's not Mickey Rooney, that's for sure. Oh boy, can I have a hint?
Okay, there is a soap opera with a very, very similar title to this
The Wars of Our Lives, which sounds very similar to the Days of Our Lives. No, okay. What's another soap?
starts with the bold and something.
The Bold and the Brave.
Very good.
Yeah, okay. So if you give me half the title, I can get the other
Well, why not?
half.
Works. All right, excellent. So would you like to tell everyone where they can find you?
You can find me on my website, fatherdavidmowry.com. I have recordings of my preaching, and I have links to the podcast episodes where I have done similar minute-by-minute analyses of great movies.
Yes, and you've been here numerous times
I
already.
have. I'm glad to be back.
And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie on Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movieonminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movieonminute@movierob.net. So I'm going to keep Father David around for Shabbat. He's going to stick around till Monday. Maybe you can go walk into Jerusalem or Bethlehem from my house if you really want to. If you're interested, if you're not, you can just stay here too. That's okay. We will both be back on Monday for another episode. But until then, Karahi!
Karahi!